Well, this is Pierre Fagrang, the host of Fight the Empire. And our guest today is Nicole, who writes under the name Stonely for The Automatic Earth. And welcome to KABU.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And also co-hosting today is Kurt Liebeszeit, who has been on this show before talking about energy and financing. And tell us, what does The Automatic Earth refer to?
Well, it's a line from a Paul Simon song called The Boy in the Bubble, which seemed very appropriate for financial bubble times.
Okay. And then you wrote an article about the financial bubble, financing the energy and the environment.
Oh, I've written many of them. Uh-huh. Many different ones on different aspects of it.
We've talked about energy and peak oil and money.
That's
and
right.
I'm so happy that Nicole could be here with us because really the work that she and her writing partner do on The Automatic Earth is first class in analyzing that kind of thing. Could you give us the URL for that, for people who might be interested?
Yes, it's http://theautomaticearth, which is all small letters and all one word, .blogspot.com.
Okay, well tell us about the financing. How does all this stuff get financed? I think in your article you mentioned a Ponzi scheme.
Essentially, modern financing is a Ponzi scheme. I mean, it derives from fractional reserve banking, where money is essentially pulled out of thin air by banks that are allowed to lend out more than the deposits they take in, on the grounds that not everyone is going to want their money back all at once. Mm-hmm. So as long as you keep enough in reserve to provide for the people who do want to take their money out, then you can lend out the rest of it. So if you ever got to a point where everyone did want their money back, you would not have enough money in the bank to be able to repay them all, and that's a bank run when you get everyone wanting their money back at once. And we've seen that to some extent, certainly in the UK, with lines round the corner at Northern Rock a couple of years ago. And we've seen the beginnings of it in various places in the U.S., but not on any great scale. The government activity so far has been able to paper over the cracks to the point where we haven't seen the traditional end of a Ponzi scheme. A Ponzi scheme is essentially where you have a fundamental dependence on the buy-in of new entrants. And a simple Ponzi scheme doesn't last very long because you're just paying the returns of the people who are already part of it from the new people you can bring in. It doesn't last very long. But if you have a system that brings in revenues to pay the people who are part of it, other than just the buy-in of new entrants, then it can last a lot longer, like the Eastern European pyramid schemes that we saw in the mid-90s. Or there are
those
other.
Those were huge, weren't they?
They were enormous. And the one in Albania managed to beggar 80% of the population by the time it was over. And the extra money didn't come from legitimate business because there really wasn't any in the country at the time. It was remittances. It was gun running, drug smuggling, human trafficking, car theft from all over Europe, you name it. They were bringing in all sorts of other revenue. It lasted a number of years until everyone was watching their neighbors get rich, and even the most skeptical people were buying into it at the end. But when the schemes collapsed, they lost everything.
That's and the wrong time to buy into it at the end. Yeah.
Absolutely. People jump on the bandwagon too little too late, and they are practically saying, give me that empty bag, because the empty bag is all that's left at the peak of a Ponzi scheme. The people who make money are the people who get in at the beginning and get out early, and they will keep what they have. The people who stay too long, whether it's a traditional Ponzi scheme or a stock market mania, which has exactly the same dynamic, the people who are still there at the end of it have absolutely nothing. They watch their stake disappear completely.
Well, didn't this start even before the fractional accounting? I mean, if you go to the bank and you, say, take out a $1,000 loan, and the banker just kind of writes it down in your account. So that 5 minutes ago, that $1,000 did not exist.
Exactly.
And then he also writes down, say, $1,500, which would be the amount that the bank gets back after you paid all your interest and, you know, taking the loan off the books. So that didn't exist either. So right away, you've got $1,000 on one side and you've got $1,500 on the other side. So there will always be more
owed,
more money owed than money to pay it.
Absolutely.
The debt is built in right from the start. And then this fractional accounting just kind of makes it worse.
Well, fractional reserve banking is part of that. Fractional mm-hmm. reserve banking goes back a very, very long time. All modern banking is based on it. And it's one of these things that, although it's a Ponzi scheme, it lasts a long time because, well, in our case, there's an enormous amount of legitimate business that puts money into it as well. So it's not a fraud in the sense of people are deliberately trying to defraud someone mm-hmm. by running the system this way, but it's a system that nevertheless has the effect of hitting a brick wall at some point where, yes, you loan money into existence, you can't keep up with the amount of interest you have to keep paying on it, and eventually
there's going to be a default.
It goes back to whence it came, which is into thin air.
And what happens then? I've always been interested in this. What are sort of some of the details? How would it affect us, you know, day to day?
Well, what happens is, what disappears primarily is credit. Asset values fall so that the amount of money people thought they had, the amount of wealth they thought they had, suddenly is a lot less than they thought.
Mainly your house.
Houses and derivatives and all sorts of things. The assets that insurance companies rely on to be able to make payouts, for instance, all these asset values fall. And so the value that people thought was part of them disappears very rapidly. But then also credit disappears. So people are not borrowing anymore. They're completely maxed out. Banks are not lending. Despite the fact that governments are plowing a lot of money into the banking system, it's disappearing into a giant hole of credit destruction. So it's not getting out into the economy at all. So people talk about inflation, but this is not inflationary. You're not seeing an increase in the amount of money in the system. What happens when you lose credit is that all of a sudden you realize that all you have left is actual money, which is about 1% of the money supply. Suddenly, there's nowhere near enough money to actually run an economy. And to make it worse, what little money there is, people recognize it as being scarce and they hoard it. So what little money there is, people are hanging on to for grim death, and they are not putting it out into the economy, so you're not seeing money circulating, and businesses simply can't operate. Like in the Depression, the economy has a seizure.
It's like what's rational for the individual to hold on to the money is not rational for the system.
That is absolutely the case. The things that it makes sense to do as an individual, the only things you can do as an individual that will make any difference to you, are the very things that will bring down the system that much more quickly.
But they tell us, you know, economic theory says that if everybody acts in their own interest, that somehow it translates to, sort of like Dr. Pangloss, you know, the best possible world or something.
Does for a while, and then it all falls flat on its face.
Well, now, there seems to be some, debate among economists and other people whether we're going to have inflation to deal with or deflation.
Well, we're facing deflation, but there's a fundamental misconception as to what inflation and deflation actually are, which is one of the things that we talk about a lot at the Automatic Earth. Inflation and deflation are monetary phenomena. Inflation is an increase in the money supply relative to available goods and services, and deflation is the opposite. Inflation is not rising prices, and deflation is not falling prices. Rising and falling prices are symptoms, lagging symptoms, of inflation or deflation. But what we've really seen, the Ponzi side of what's been going on, is really the enormous expansion in the money supply that we've seen. For instance, the notional value of the derivatives market is approximately $250 billion, and 30 years ago it was nothing. So all that amount of putative value has been pulled out of a hat in 30 years, to a staggeringly large multiple of global GDP. So you've had this enormous expansion in what people consider to hold value, an expansion in the money supply, almost all of which is credit. And what inflation does is, if you have a real wealth pie, imagine you have a pie, and you simply divide it into more and more and more pieces. Each piece gets smaller and smaller, but you still own the piece that you originally had. It's not as big as it once was, but it's still yours. What happens with a credit expansion, like the one we've lived through, is you have the same real wealth pie, but what you do is, instead of cutting it into smaller pieces, you create multiple and mutually exclusive claims to the same pieces of pie.
Sort of like overlaying them in a way.
Yes. So the pieces of pie still look the same as ever. People still think they have what they had before.
The number of houses, what they have in their bank accounts.
Yes.
The money that is in their pockets, etc.
Yes.
Just the real wealth of a society, whatever it might be, whether it's goods and services or whatever. But now there's all this other claim layered over it.
Yes, there could be 100 claims to every single piece of pie. And everyone thinks that they own it. And as long as nobody's really selling things, nobody notices that there are all these the multiple claims to every bit of underlying real wealth. The problem comes when people start to actually try and take
mm-hmm.
what they have to reclaim it, like with the bank run where you try to take money out of the bank. If people try to make claims or sell what they have because they're trying to cash out, all of a sudden everyone's trying to sell the same things, and all those claims are extinguished. The excess claims just simply disappear into thin air.
In a default, essentially.
Exactly. There's mm-hmm. a mass default. And you end up with a rather chaotic wealth grab for what is actually there. And that's what deflation does. Deflation is the elimination of these excess claims, because that's what credit is, excess claims to underlying real wealth. When credit is gone and all you have left is actual money, you really haven't got very much of it. I mean, imagine if you had to do everything in cash, buy houses, buy cars. One of the first things that would happen is the prices of all those things would absolutely plummet, because there'd be hardly anyone who was able to pay cash for these things, and the amount of cash they would have, they would be able to pay, would be vastly less than they can pay now mm-hmm. with access to credit. So you could easily see asset prices fall by 90%, including real estate, although I would expect there to be tremendous local variation.
What about local currencies? You know, you've had them in Ithaca, New York now for a long, long time. And there's one that recently started right up the river in Hood River. I think it's been around a year or two.
There's one in Corvallis.
And there's one on Salt Spring Island.
Oh, mm-hmm. cool. So what are they, is that a way that people can kind of get along better?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Local currencies can make a tremendous difference in a depression. I mean, Wörgl in Austria, they had a system like that really got the economy going in the depths of the depression, until it was shut down by the powers that be because they perceived it as a threat. If you have a local currency, everything is happening locally, but you're not the central government doesn't get anything out of it. Whereas if you have a central currency, all the taxes are paid to the center. So the center benefits from you using the main currency for your country. As soon as you start to do your own thing, there's no way for the center to cream off a share of it. So they object to this, and they do tend to shut these things down if they become successful. But nevertheless, they can be a tremendous way of making an enormous difference locally, even if they only do so for a relatively short mm-hmm. time.
Well, the center cannot tax that? I thought they could if they consider it income, you know?
It's essentially a form of barter. Because mm-hmm. there's no mechanism for the center to claim money in whatever passes for currency in a local area.
Really?
The system just doesn't allow that.
Yeah, they probably nominally have that capacity, but the ability to actually, you know, the system isn't evolved to mm-hmm. handle that kind of transaction, and mm-hmm. so the IRS really doesn't have its hooks into knowing what's going on. Mm-hmm. They probably don't have the reporting forms, blah, blah.
Exactly. And they wouldn't let you pay in scrip of whatever kind. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the definition of the approved currencies that you can pay your taxes with.
Right.
Exactly. And so you would not be able to, they wouldn't even know how to value whatever scrip you were using in terms of whatever currency they were using.
Mm.
So it just isn't something that fits into a currency system. So it is perceived as a threat. But nevertheless, for a period of time, these things can be tremendously successful, and they can make the difference between real suffering and people being able to maintain economic activity. And one of the ways they did it in Austria was the scrip actually declined in value over time. So mm-hmm. It made no sense to hoard it, because it would decrease in value if you did. So that got money moving in their local economy enormously. They did a lot of building work, and they really did not feel like they were in a depression, whereas everywhere around them did.
Yeah, they had something like 100% employment in that town.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, similar thing in Bavaria, too, I believe. Mm. But what about state banks? You know, they have one. They've had one in North Dakota for 90 years, and it's the State Bank of North Dakota. Mm. They can, you know, I guess they can float their own bonds, and that when people deposit money, the interest goes to the state of North Dakota, acting presumably on behalf of the people rather than banks back east. And I sort of wonder why more people don't think we should have one. Maybe California could use one,
yeah.
You know, and we could use one. We could all use one, you know. That way, you know, the interest is this interest rate, which is getting really onerous, you know, it goes to the people.
Yes, and we do need much more locally responsive financial institutions. Part of the problem is that we have these enormous globalized banks, and they've all been engaging in a massive amount of casino capitalism, which is essentially what the derivatives market is. It's all bets on movements of underlying assets, that, and then the bets themselves come to have value, and you can make bets on the movements of the value of those underlying bets, which is, it just is ridiculous. But if you have no local accountability, the bankers are not looking at whether the people they make loans to can ever repay them.
Because they got the fee, they're
they
out the door.
They make a fee, that's right. Mm-hmm. They make the money, they're gone. They sell the risk onto Wall Street through mortgage securities or securitization of other kinds of obligations. And so they don't care if that person is ever able to pay that money back. So you get a global spreading of risk. You get systemic risk. It's supposed to eliminate risk doing this.
By sharing,
but it absolutely doesn't. It just spreads it around to the point where it undermines the entire system. And even a lot of banks at the moment that are quite safe, bank ratings that are better than other banks, nevertheless, the chances of them being able to withstand a systemic banking crisis are not high, because if people get it into their heads that they have to take their money out of the bank, they're not going to stop and check the rating of the bank that their money is in before they do that. So simply, that kind of dynamic flicks a switch in people's heads, and then they go and they take their money out. So that's the kind of thing that the system is particularly worried about. So that's why they've been trying to prop up the banking system, even although it means throwing trillions of dollars into a black hole where it's never going to do anyone any good. All they're really doing is buying time, though, because ultimately you can't prevent a Ponzi scheme from collapsing. Ponzi schemes collapse 100% of the time. It's merely a question of inflating it a little bit more in the short term at the expense of making the collapse worse later on.
Well, what happens then?
Then you rebuild from the ground up, and you probably get a tremendous amount of local variation. And to some extent, that's going to depend a lot on the kind of social structures and culture and relationships that exist in particular areas, whether there are a lot of horizontal relationships between people or whether they're very atomized and separated. And if you look at, say, Cuba and North Korea, they were both communist systems. They both faced a tremendous loss of oil very quickly and really difficult circumstances, and they had to rebuild.
They had very different outcomes.
They had completely different outcomes, because in Cuba, the horizontal structures were already there. People were already practicing organic agriculture, and there simply wasn't the same kind of collapse. In North Korea, where everything was extremely hierarchical, everything was top down from the party down to the people, and there were no other organizations. Everything was the party or nothing. North Korea is starving, and their suffering that they've experienced there has been absolutely staggering. But they were in a very similar situation to Cuba. Of course, they didn't have quite as nice a climate as Cuba. Cuba does have other advantages, but still, it's a path dependency approach, that where you start from can profoundly determine what you can do when you have to face a crisis. Personally, I think the Northwest is quite well positioned for that relative to many other places, because from what I've seen here, and I'm not native to this area, but from what I've seen here, the culture is quite different from where I come from in Eastern Ontario. I see a lot of people who work together. I don't see anything like as atomized a society as in many other places in North America.
Well, I think of a better climate. We have more water, you know. It's better than living in Las Vegas, I think. That's for sure. But
a moment ago, to return to something I think that Per wanted to talk about, you mentioned the center. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this concept of empire and how...
Entropy.
And entropy, and how they sort of work a bit, because it's a unique and interesting analysis.
Well, entropy is a physical concept where if you're trying to maintain a concentration gradient of something, imagine heat in your house, for instance, you're trying to keep your house warm while everything around it is cold. You can keep your house warm, but you have to put a lot of energy into doing that. You have to pump energy in continuously to maintain that gradient, that disparity. So you're constantly pushing heat uphill, if you like, when it would naturally roll downhill
and just to flow
equalize.
Out, and just flow out of your
yes,
house.
Yes, you would have, if you stopped heating your house, the temperature would equalize with the outside, and you know, you would be living in a very cold place in the winter or a very hot place in the summer if you come from where I come from. But empires work this way. They have wealth conveyors, and they take – there's a tremendous amount of energy that goes into maintaining wealth gradients, wealth disparities. So globalization has allowed us to extend our fingers to the point where we can pick the pockets of almost the entire world. And what we're doing is using the energy of fossil fuels to drive a wealth concentration gradient in reverse of the direction it would naturally go. Naturally, you would get equalization, but what you get is a tremendous concentration of wealth at the center. So we are lucky enough in all of North America and the developed world, or almost all of it, to be living at effectively the center at that large level. And we are living the lifestyle we live at the expense of the people whose resources we are removing from their countries. We take the resources, but we leave them with all the environmental externalities, the mess, the pollution, the ruined countries, the polluted water, reduces the water supplies they have available to themselves, the health effects. So we leave them all the negative side of the resources that they had under their soil. We take the resources back to our own countries where we use them. So we're pushing wealth towards us, and at every stage we concentrate it. So there are many different levels of wealth concentration. Globalization is only one, but the same thing happens at a national level. The same thing happens at a provincial or a state level, at a municipal level. Companies are the same. What they're doing is they're creaming off surpluses from the periphery in order to concentrate it at the center. And so you can be, if you're poor in America, it's probably because you're in the periphery of the center. So as far as America goes, you're in the periphery. But as far as the world goes, you're still at the center.
I think you've mentioned it's almost like the geometric fractals.
Yes. Yes, it's essentially a fractal system where you have self-similar structures at various degrees of trend, and they're all operating simultaneously. Financial markets work like this as well. I mean, you can plot out fractal patterns in financial markets at different degrees of trend. Ecological cycles work this way. So panarchy, which is C.S. Holling's theory, is looking at how you have different ecological cycles at different scales and how the smaller scales feed into the larger ones and how the larger scale sets the context for the smaller ones, so that provided you have the larger cycle still perfectly intact, you can easily recover from collapses at a much smaller level. Say a forest fire, where within the area that's burned, you have a tremendous amount of destruction, but you have all the seeds of all the species that grew there, and they will reseed themselves and regrow. If you have a massive conflagration, because you'd been putting out all the little fires for years and allowed the understory to grow up, allow the trees to have to compete for nutrients and for water, and then be weakened and susceptible to pine beetles, then they die. You end up with an enormous amount of combustible material. The kind of fire you can get from something like that is so massive that you actually don't have anything left to rebuild from in the same way. You have a much deeper collapse. So you really, it's a much harder job to recover from that kind of thing. What you need is resilience, where you have more in the way of capacity to recover. You try to retain the capacity to rebuild. And that's really what our system has been eliminating for the last few years. We've been, in the name of economic efficiency, getting rid of all the kinds of resilience because they look like a waste of money. If you have two ways of doing something, well, you had to pay for two ways of doing it. And so if you eliminate one of them, you're only paying for one. But then you have no backup. You have no reserve. So your system is very brittle. Unfortunately, our financial system, as well as our ecological system and energy system, are tremendously brittle right now. And what we're risking is a kind of deep collapse. But by warning people, I'm hoping that people will look towards being able to build aspects of resilience in their own lives so that they're less dependent on the larger system. The larger system can be thought of as a set of life support systems. But if those life support systems become unreliable, people need to be able to do things for themselves. They're going to need to know how to grow food, for instance. They're going to need to think about how they might heat and cook. There are a lot of things that people have never had to think of before. They've only had to flick a switch, and there it is.
Yeah, because we've enjoyed living at the center in this efficient, brittle system.
Mm-hmm. In your article on entropy, you talk a lot about the Roman Empire.
And yes.
It's like their energy source was not oil, it was food.
And wood as well.
And wood, huh?
So, for instance, if you want to bring wood to Rome, there's a limit to how far you can go out from Rome before it takes you more energy to bring mm-hmm. the wood back to Rome as it does as the energy would get out of it. So that's very much what's happening with oil now. The parallel is that, yes, there is oil in the ground. There's still probably half the oil that ever existed in the ground. But what we've done is we've used up the oil that was easiest and cheapest to mm-hmm. get at. So what's left, we have to put a lot more money and a lot more energy into retrieving for ourselves. So if you look at the amount of energy that's actually left once you've taken out the energy you had to expend to get more energy, the net amount of energy available to society falls much, much more quickly than you would expect from the gross energy decline that you would get from a normal production peak and decline. So you can find that the amount of energy that you have falls off very, very steeply. That's very much the situation that we're in now. We appear to have seen a production peak globally in oil. We are approaching one in coal and natural gas, conventional natural gas. We still have other fuels. For instance, there's tight formation gas, shale gas, coal-based methane, and people talk about, oh, we don't have to worry, we have all these things. But the amount of energy it takes to get them is far higher than what we have now. The net energy that you get out of that is far lower. What you're doing is having to run faster and faster on the treadmill, and you still can't keep up to where you were before. So it's going to be an enormous problem, the amount of energy that we have.
Well, wouldn't a good example be the Alberta tar sands?
Oh, absolutely. The energy return on energy invested, which is a measure of net energy, for the tar sands, I'd be surprised if it was even 3-1. Whereas in the early days of oil, it was 100-1. Mm-hmm. You practically had to stick a straw in the ground and out it would come, and you didn't have to really do any work at all.
Well, the iconic image of the gusher.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. They were.
Sure.
Yes, gushers in East Texas, gushers in Saudi Arabia.
Pennsylvania. That's the first gusher was in Pennsylvania, I believe.
Yes, but we don't have gushers now. Even in mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia, where we think of as being the place with 100 years of oil supply, they're doing a lot of extremely complicated things to get the last dregs of oil out of their fields. And they don't have anywhere near the amount of oil people think they do. What they do have is getting harder and harder to get. Their fields are watering out. The seawater is encroaching into the oil fields. They're already getting a vast amount more water than oil when they pump things, when they pump stuff out of a Saudi Arabian oil well. We don't have anything like the reserves people think that we do. And America is already, I believe, of the order of about 85% depleted. Russia is probably similar, although we think of Russia as having a lot of oil. The Middle East is less depleted than that, but they're still heavily depleted. So it's really going to be very difficult to get hold of the amount of oil that we need to maintain our current socioeconomic complexity. Essentially, it will be impossible to do that going forward. And financial crisis will make it that much more difficult. Initially, what happens with the financial crisis is because people can't afford energy, they can't afford much of anything because they don't have any money, and demand is not what you want, it's what you can pay for. Demand falls, so the price of energy falls. You could get oil falling to $20 or $30 a barrel, possibly. But that wouldn't mean it was cheap. People would still find it a lot less affordable than it is now because their purchasing power would have fallen even faster than the price. But what that low price would do, wouldn't make oil cheap, but it would mean nobody would invest in oil. Nobody would be wanting to produce new fields if all they could make was $20 a barrel. Their cost structure is higher than that, and their costs would not fall as quickly as the price of oil.
So it's a double-edged sword.
I think on that note, we'll have to end this show. I want to thank Nicole, also known as Stoneleaf, for being our guest. And I want to thank Kurt Liebeszeit for being my co-host.
Thank you very much.
And this has been Fight the Empire. Stay tuned. There's always something good on KBOO.